the CMU podcast, in association with 7Digital.
This week, NME, Sony Music, PRS and 65 Days of Static. Hey everyone, we're back in London, both of us. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. I have with me Chris Cook, actually with me this week in the room, who is business editor of CMU. Hello, Chris.
That sort of implies that I was the one who wasn't in the studio last week and that I was off gallivanting around Europe.
Whereas
I was here, ready to record. It was you that was Skyping in.
Well, who can say who was in the wrong?
I think I preferred it when you were Skyping in. It would be really good if every so often you could sort of go as if there's a sort of a wobble in the Skype line, because I enjoyed that. I think that was my favourite thing about last week's podcast.
So if I just... every now and...
That's a vast improvement on previous podcasts. And I suppose before we should start, we should confirm we left last week on a bit of a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And it's our duty to make good on the cliffhanger. So did your ferry sink?
It did not.
It did not sink.
However, there was another cliffhanger which I couldn't even have foreseen. It said on the ferry that you have to turn the alarm system on your car off when you park it, but I don't know how to do that, so I didn't bother, and I didn't know if my alarm was going to go off or not. It didn't.
Right.
Anyway, that's just like a little side story.
That is an exciting thing. Is that so that our rather mediocre cliffhanger from last week will seem good compared to the story you've just told? Is that what you were trying to do there?
Yeah, I suppose so.
Hey, talking about excitement.
Yeah.
It's New Music Friday.
It is. Well,
today,
it will be when this goes out.
By the time you hear this, we're doing a bit of acting. It's New Music Friday.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
This is very exciting news indeed. And I know that people listening to this will think, well, he's being sarcastic because that's his shtick. But I'm genuinely excited about New Music Fridays because...
No, you aren't.
Three of my favourite things are music, Friday and newness. And never before have all three of those been put together. So it's a brave new era. I can't think of anything that's ever happened in music that's more exciting than this. So...
Let's stop and have a think then.
Have a think. You're trying to make me think of something more exciting that's happened to this. More exciting than New Music Fridays. Actually...
Oh, I was going to say I can't think of anything.
I thought of something. Do you remember when the actor who played Henry in Neighbours suddenly showed up in Home and Away? I think perhaps that was more exciting than New Music Fridays.
Yeah, vaguely, yeah. It was a big thing, I remember.
But other than that...
This is a big thing.
This is a big thing. So today is New Music Fridays. It's the global release day.
Yep.
People keep calling it the global release date. It's not a global release date.
All releases are not going to come out today.
Because that would suggest that there would be one day in the year where all new releases would come out. It is a global release day. So for the first time ever, every country, all the record companies, I say every country, actually the press release said something like...
45.
Yeah, there are more than... Ask Deezer. Ask Deezer. There are 4,009 countries, according to Deezer. There are more than 45 countries. But... in all of the big markets where sort of the record industry is sizable, it's always been in the past that music has come out on different days in different countries. So in the UK, it was always Monday. In the US, it was always Tuesday. In Australia, in recent years, it's been Friday. And as of today, new music will go live on the high street and in iTunes and on the streaming platforms on a Friday at midnight local time.
Yeah.
So not exactly at the same time worldwide, but they're assuming that most people are in bed. So by the time you wake up on Friday morning, all the new releases will be there. It's all to help artists who tweet, isn't it? That's the idea.
I guess.
So that artists can now send out one tweet saying, my new record's out, rather than having to send out a tweet on Monday saying, my new record's out in Britain. And another one saying, my new record's out in America. And then another one saying, my new record's out. So now they can just do one tweet.
Well, it's also apparently they announced today that it's to cut down on the window for piracy. So if you're in Australia, all the people in England are tweeting about stuff, great new music from Monday. And in those, 4 days when you don't have it, you're going to be tempted to pirate that music, apparently.
So
it's going to stop that.
Any Australians listening to this podcast, I'm sure we have Australians listening to this podcast, take note, you no longer have an excuse, okay? Up until this point, we've sort of been going, all right then, you have an excuse to rip off all of our content off of whatever, Pirate Bay or Kick-Ass Torrents or your piracy channel of choice. But from this point onwards, none of that, no more piracy. You have to go and pay for the content, or between now and the end of September, go listen to it for free on Apple Music, because that's what it's all about in this generation.
Yeah.
You know, we're not here today to talk about New Music Fridays. I just got so excited because it's New Music Friday. I apologise for that.
Yeah, we should talk about something else.
I read out a list
and New Music Friday was not on it. So let's talk about the NME going free. The NME has announced, after a long, long period of speculation...
About 47 years, I think.
Yeah, that it is going to cease to be a magazine sold in newsagents. It is going to become a free title handed out outside train stations.
Like all the other ones.
So many of them.
Yeah, if you live in London, like we do, obviously there's a free magazine pretty much every day of the week now. So I think you get Time Out on Tuesday, Shortlist on Wednesday, Stylist on Thursday. Now, I recognise that Shortlist is for men and Stylist is for women, okay?
Yeah.
But you are allowed to pick up both, okay? They don't do a gender check. Then there's that tedious sport magazine on a Friday. I don't know what that's about.
So, sport, I guess.
Sport, yes. So I'm guessing NME will be coming out on a Monday because it's the only day of the week left when you can be handing out a magazine and not be competing with somebody else.
Yeah, though it's traditionally a Wednesday thing, isn't it? So that's going to confuse everyone.
Well, but the music industry is changing when it comes to days of the week.
It's true. And you say it's traditionally a Wednesday and people know the NME comes out on a Wednesday, but no one's been buying it, have they?
No. So the NME's print circulation has been declining for a long time. Now, to be fair, every print magazine's circulation has been declining. The vast majority of magazines that you buy at the newsagent, they get their circulation figures independently verified by an organisation called ABC because advertisers demand it. So it means that every twice a year, I think it is with magazines, or sometimes once a year, depending on the title, these figures come out, the ABC figures they're called, and so we can see how the different music magazines have been doing. And every time those figures come out, every magazine has lost a few thousand on the previous set of figures because people aren't buying print magazines in the way that they used to. But I think NME has lost its readership faster than most, which I suspect is a demographic thing, really, because it is pitched at sort of people in their mid to late teens, predominantly.
Yeah. Well, there have been various revamps of it, haven't there? And it always seems... It never seems really to get to grips with who it's aiming at anymore. It tries to aim at the younger audience and kind of, I don't know, a slightly older audience. And it's kind of like, it's not that the content isn't good, it's just it never seems to be quite pitched right.
You're not quite sure who they're aiming at. And so in the most recent ABC figures, it had dropped really close to 15,000.
Yeah.
Bearing in mind that, you know, back in its heyday, 100,000 plus NME was selling every week. Now down to just under 15, well, I say just over 15,000. I would suspect in the subsequent 6 months, it's gone to just under 15,000, or maybe quite a bit under 15,000. And as we've seen this decline, I mean, it is worth also mentioning that while the magazine has been in freefall, and it has been for a long time, actually, of all the music magazines, NME.com, in terms of traffic, does pretty well. And it was one of the few music mags that put all of its, well, the vast majority of its content online from the start. They also have lots of other content that's only available on the website. So whereas lots of the other music mags initially, and a handful of cases still, really use their website to sell subscriptions to the print magazine, NME.com lives beyond the print magazine and has a pretty sizable audience.
Yeah, and that's always been the spin on it. Every time the circulation figures come out and people go, wow, that's not good, is it? The NME would come out with a statement saying, oh, but you have to look at us as a wider media organisation. We have lots of different things. Lots of people reading our website. We do other things. We have fingers in the other pies. And the magazine is a part of that. It is not the main thing. It's just the sort of... heritage part of it. I mean, they never said it was the heritage part of it, but
that's what
it is. Yeah.
It's interesting, yeah, because their press releases always used to be trying to sort of say, you know, oh, well, actually, in the wider picture, it's not that bad. But actually, in more recent years, they just don't talk about their print circulation figures in their press releases. They always talk about the readership across all of the platforms. But as those sales of the print edition have been in freefall for a number of years, I mean, various people, both within the industry and certain commentators, and I think a lot of people in the music business and probably quite a few NME readers, have sort of said, well, why don't you follow what Time Out did? So Time Out used to sell at the newsagent. It saw its circulation decline hugely in terms of print. They had a website that they were trying to turn into a decent business. And then a few years ago, they said, well, OK, let's stop selling our magazine at the newsagent. Let's have a new version, which was streamlined. You don't get all the stuff you used to get. So it'll be interesting to see what the free NME looks like. But let's have a free mag make it a little bit cheaper to produce, sell a load of advertising, distribute it all over London, and actually Enemy will be going beyond London through sort of retail partners and through universities. Try and cover all of our costs through advertising and then use the magazine to really sell our online services and get more people signing up online. Then earlier this year, a rumour went round that it was actually happening, and it was happening imminently, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there've been, every time the circulation figures come out for the last few years, people have gone, oh, well, you know, when are they either going to shut it down or make it a free magazine? And there have been various rumours along you know, that time when it's been like, oh, the Enemy's going free at the end of next month. And then I think it was in February, it was confirmed that Time Inc. UK, who publish Enemy, were generally considering taking it free. And now, I mean, it's interesting that the period, the next period for ABC figures has just ended, at which point they've made this announcement, which does suggest that when those figures are announced, they're not going to be good.
But when Time Inc. made that admission, that it was something that was being considered, that was following a rumour that came out, I think on the day of their awards event, that said, it's going free next month.
Yeah.
And then it turned out that that was the result of someone at Vice magazine, I think, had spoken to their news agent round the corner from the office. And their news agent had said, oh, that's going free next week. And then it all went all over the internet. Oh, Enemy's in me, going free. And then Time Inc. said, no, it's not going free next month. But it is something we're thinking about. And so they thought about it. It's happening in September, I think.
September the 18th.
So it will be interesting to see various things. It'll be interesting to see what the free title's like and how it compares to the edition that's currently being sold. It'll be interesting to see where they distribute it. You know, will it be in London exactly where Time Out and Shortlist is distributed? What retail partners are going to have it? What universities and colleges are going to have it? I mean, that is probably the most important bit, getting it into sort of the student world, because some people were saying, well, it's all well and good giving out Time Out at Liverpool Street Station, but that's not the target audience for Enemy. Now, you're saying that Enemy hasn't really been that clear on who their target audience are for some time, so perhaps they will expand it out and try and hit a bigger age demographic. But certainly they do need to be hitting people who are not commuting through stations in London. And so,
well, the thing is, Tim, I think the part of the problem is probably that they have, you know, a target audience, a remit, but at the same time, they were trying to hit people who would pay for magazines, and those people aren't their target audience. So it's possible that there'll be a clearer picture of who it is they're aiming at now. And they're going to be upping the circulation to 300,000.
Yeah, from the 15,000 they're currently selling. And that's way more than they ever printed, even in the heyday of selling it each week. So, lots to look out for in the autumn. And I think, for a title that has been doing pretty well online in recent years, but who has always been dogged by these, you know, twice a year, oh my God, they're selling less. Surely you reach a point where it's not economically viable to continue publishing this magazine, however well the brand may be doing elsewhere. And I think this will probably have a bit more excitement around the magazine. And
they made it sound exciting, didn't they? A big headline.
It's
going to be a brand transformation.
Exactly. I mean, all sarcasm aside, okay, this is me being genuine this time. I think it is quite exciting that Enemy is going free. But the way they described it on their own website, clearly it had been written by PR and not by the people who write the magazine. What was it? It was Enemy set for
brand transformation.
Just say, we're going free. That's what your readers want to know. So anyway, all the same for the time being, but come September, an all-new look Enemy. Pick it up at your station if you're in London, at a retail shop. I've been caught Enemy speak.
Retail, the physical digital download. That's a retail shop.
Or at your school or college. And let's see if this could sort of be the great new era of the new musical express.
Now, last week we discussed 19 Entertainment's lawsuit against Sony Music and the new addition to that lawsuit. This week we're going to discuss it again because Sony Music has responded to that and possibly, I don't know, depending on what you were expecting, it may or may not be what you were expecting.
Yes, now there's a statement.
let's get a bit more clear about yes, recap. What
let's
happened?
Do an incredibly quick recap. Although, obviously, if you didn't listen to last week's podcast, well, you should. In fact, if this is the first time you've ever listened to our podcast, the rule is you have to go back to not the first edition 4 years ago. We're not going to force you to do that, but you should go back to the recent editions, and you'll hear us talking about this lawsuit. This lawsuit's been rumbling for quite a while now. 19 is the company behind the American Idol franchise. And as part of that, as well as owning the concept of the TV show, they also manage the careers of many of the pop stars that come through the programme. So the winners and the finalists and many of the people who have sort of launched a career on the back of Idol are still managed by the management bit of 19. However, most of those finalists, certainly the ones from the first few years of American Idol, were signed, as far as the label is concerned, to Sony Music. So they're sort of, they're managed by 19 over here, but their albums and singles were released by Sony over here, so there are contracts between the two. And then last year, I think, 19 suddenly sued Sony. And it, as we said on last week's podcast, we have a big long list of gripes, and they were sort of all the classic gripes that artists and managers have when they work with record companies, and especially major record companies. So,
they're just throwing them all
at us. What's happening to the music as it moves around the company, stuff about, you know, our downloads, sales or license, all the things that people have been debating and squabbling about in recent years. But then last week they added an extra little bit to their lawsuit, or indeed they filed new papers with the court saying we want to add an extra section.
Yeah.
We want another bit of this lawsuit. And that was all to do with the equity that the big record companies like Sony and all the record companies, and actually the indies too, through Merlin, have taken in services like Spotify. So if you set up a streaming service today, as part of the initial deal you do with the big record companies, they will want to take some equity, have some shares in your business. And actually, we found out this week through the new submission that Sony had about 6% of Spotify. That may well have been watered down in subsequent years, but way back when they first did a deal with Spotify, they took 6% of the company as part of the deal.
Yeah, and so 19's accusation is that Sony, and in fact it said this about all the majors, but obviously Sony is the one it's going for here, said that Sony took that equity and in exchange for that agreed to lower royalty rates because it has to pay royalties over to artists to share that money, whereas equity, it doesn't have to share with the artists at all. So that was 19 were like, well, what's happening to that money as well? We want to add that to our lawsuit.
And 19 are not alone in questioning the equity that the majors have taken in streaming services. With those two elements to the debate, which is firstly, well, how big a share do the majors have in streaming services like Spotify? What will those shares be worth if and when Spotify floats or gets sold? There are rumours this week that maybe Facebook will buy Spotify. We'll chat a little bit about that later. But you know, when that big transaction happens, how much will the majors make and what will happen to that money? Will they share it with their artists or will they keep it all? And then, as you say, 19's allegation being, well, if they're going to keep it all, then when they're doing their deal with streaming services, and we know that when a label licenses a streaming platform like Spotify, there are various parts to the deal. There are minimum guarantees, there are upfront advances, there's the revenue share arrangement, which actually is the core of the deal. That's the big bit of the arrangement long term. And there's the equity. And they're sort of saying, well, you have to share some of that money with your artists, but not all of it. So are you therefore at the negotiating table prone to say, well, give us more here where we don't have to share the money, and we'll let you pay less here where we do have to share the money, and everyone's happy, apart from 19 and every single artist on the planet.
Yes. And so 19 has requested that this be added to its lawsuit. So Sony has had to respond.
And they don't want it added, needless to
say. Yes, but Sony's response was basically, yeah, and?
And it was, I suppose, in some ways, that's not a surprise because off the record, record companies, when you've talked to them about this in the past, have always said, well, when we sign artists, the contract is pretty clear about this, that we share money with artists when we make money directly from one of their recordings. So if we sell a CD, then we have to share the money because clearly that money was made selling the CD. And if we sync a record to an advert, we have to share that money because clearly that was that specific recording that generated that revenue. But if we just make some money out of our catalogue, And it isn't from a specific recording in that catalogue. It's just that we do a generic deal, then we don't have to share that money. Artist contracts are quite clear on that. And therefore, when Spotify floats, when we get that big payday, it's ours for keeping. And that's what labels have said off the record. Although it was interesting when they had the issue about breakage a couple of months ago, that the labels were much more conciliatory. They didn't just say, well, we don't have to share that money with you, read your contract. They did say they were going to share the money, the unallocated advances that they get.
Well, that said, that debate was a PR issue and this is a legal issue.
Yes. So one was all the artists shouting about something and it was a PR move to try and shut the artists up, albeit with a bit of an ambiguous commitment. Whereas this is, yes, cold legal action. And as you say, here, basically, Sony was stating in quite clear terms, well, this is the way artist deal work. These are the powers that we have when we negotiate terms. It's not our job to structure streaming deals so that 19 get as much money as possible. That's not our obligation. We've not done any deals below market value. You know, we are doing decent deals. Artists benefit from those decent deals. But you know, we're allowed to do this, so shut up, 19, and Mr. Judge, don't let them add this to their litigation. So aside from what all of this means to the actual ongoing Sony versus 19 lawsuit, because this has been going on for some time, Sony tried to get the entire case dismissed, and I think the judge said some of it can go for various reasons, but most of it will proceed to court.
Well, there's so much of it.
Yeah, all that big long list. But whatever happens within this case, it will be interesting to see how artists and managers respond to this, because this is quite a clear statement from Sony, albeit to the courts rather than to them, that when that Spotify money comes in, you, the artist, probably won't see anything from it. And that's off. That's fine. That's our prerogative. There's nothing you can do about that.
No. And Sony said 19's latest claims are futile, which I guess is them again trying to stamp this as being the whole thing being ridiculous, and they're throwing so much stuff because they want to make something stick and sort of trying to paint the whole lawsuit as just ridiculous and let's just make the whole thing go away. So we'll see if it gets to court.
They also mentioned the LimeWire settlement.
Yes.
Which is worth mentioning for two reasons. A, because there is a parallel that when the majors do their settlement deals with the big piracy services and they actually get money in, so not like when the Pirate Bay founders were ordered to pay money to the labels and they never did, but when LimeWire was found guilty of copyright infringement in court, they did a settlement, they got lots of money, and artist managers have always said, well, what happened to that money? Do we get a cut of that money? But also, there is a parallel there between a big chunk of change coming into the majors. Do they share it in the same way they'll have that big pile of cash from Spotify? But they were quite specific of saying, American legal precedent is quite clear. We don't have to share our piracy settlements, and that by the same protocol, we don't have to share our Spotify equity income. And this is also relevant because actually the 19 case, the earlier edition, specifically mentions the LimeWire money as one of its gripes.
Yes, one of the many gripes that we've covered. But yes, that's yes. It said so. Sony is free to retain the full amount of any such settlements that suits yield. So hey, that's fun. But if I say as we lamented last week, this will probably be settled at some point. But if it did get to court, it would be fun.
So we've still got our fingers crossed. We're still touching all the wood that is in this studio that it does get to court, because it would give some sort of judicial clarity on some issues that have rumbled around for years.
Well, that's it covers so many issues that have been big talking points, not just in this lawsuit, but just across the industry for several years now. And yeah, if there was a court ruling on even one or two of these things, it would give a greater clarity to the modern music industry.
It would. And although obviously it would only have power within the American jurisdiction, I think it would have influence beyond that in terms of how contractual terms should be interpreted. So, will it get to court? Will it not get to court? But in the meantime, after all of that a couple of months ago, Sony and Universal seeming to be going, hey, artists, it's fine. We love you. It's nice to see a major record company doing what we expect of major record companies and basically saying, screw you, we can do what we like. So yay for Sony for conforming to norm. Well, I think that's enough legalities for now, although we have got more legalities to come.
So
if that's what you tune
quick
in
break.
For, stay tuned for more. But it's time for the quick CMU approved recap, where Andy tells us about the artists and the tracks that we've been approving in the CMU Daily this week. Actually, this week, 50% of the approved came from Ali, our other approver, rather than yourself. But you're willing to explain why Ali has approved these tracks too. So, as always, I will shout out the name of the artist we've approved, and you can give us a little bit of background information and tell us why they are definitely artists and tracks that people should be checking out. So we'll start at the top. Tell us about Klein.
So Klein are a duo, previously called Nick Klein, which was confusing because it's a duo.
And one of them is called Nick Klein.
Yes, so. But it's Nick Klein and Ferdus Dezad. See if I pronounced that right. Their Facebook page just says, for unforeseen reasons, they've had to change their name. Not sure if there's another Nick Klein. But anyway, so they've got this new track out. It's their first track under their new name, and it's a kind of R&B influenced pop that it could have been a bit too slick, but there's a sort of tension between the voice and the production that make it more interesting. And I think that there's something worth keeping an eye on. And sort of, I guess, a bit of a James Blakey sort of element to it a bit, but not quite as experimental as him. Well, I like James Blake.
Well, there you go. Number two, Rai Rai.
So Rai Rai. So this is one written by Ali. Very pleased to see Ali's writing back in CMU. There's been a bit of a break, and she always picks good stuff that I've not heard of. So that's good. This is the Baltimore rapper Rai Rai and Bullion, the producer on the track. And it's been released on Django Django's Dave McLean's label, Kick and Clap, and he said that he was rooting around in an old MP3 player and found this track amongst a load of his own old recordings, and the file was just called Bum Spider, and he couldn't
and it was a Bullion track,
but he had no other information on it. He didn't know what it was, and he spent ages trying to work out who'd made it. Google searching, tweeting about it, couldn't get anywhere. And then eventually someone said, oh, I know that track, it's by Bullion. So he tracked down Bullion and said, I'm completely obsessed with this track, I have to release it. And then they did a new version, he got Rai Rai in to rap on it. And you can see why he's... obsessed with it. It's a good track.
So Rai Rai feature Bullion, and the track's called Keep Up.
It is, yes.
Next, Officer.
Officer, who... it's released a new single called My Darling Defibrillator, which is, I think, the third track off his debut album, which is interesting in itself. The album's out at the end of this month. It's called Myriads. And it was created because it was crowdfunded by his fans, although it was crowdfunded behind his back without his knowledge.
This is the album.
The album, yes.
Yes. So his fans were so sort of sitting there thinking, when are you going to do an album? When are you going to do an album? Without him being involved, they raised the money and said, right, go and do an album.
Yeah, apparently they turned up at a pub. Possibly, I'm not sure if it was a pub where he was playing a gig, but they turned up at a pub in London and went, here is cash, go and record an album. And it's good. I mean, the three tracks I've heard of are really good. It's quite interesting. I mean, on the face of it, you'd think he's sort of, singer-songwritery, bit acoustic, but he does really, really interesting songs. And this one particularly, it's got this very deliberate pace, and it kind of falls into this quite dark chorus. And it's just, I don't know, it's a real slow builder of a track, and one that I've listened to quite a lot now, and I've really grown to like a lot.
And finally, Mikachu and the Shapes is back.
Yes. So Mika Levy kind of took a break from Mikachu and the Shapes while she was recording the soundtrack for Under the Skin.
Which I believe was very good.
It was I very much like the film, and I very much like the soundtrack as well. It's really good. But now she's back. Mikachu and the Shapes have recorded a new album, which they're releasing in September. The first track from it is Oh Baby, which was released this week, which Ali described as a scribbly yet sweet love song with hidden teeth, which sounds, in a good way, like it's coming from inside a bin.
And, in a good way.
In a good way. And I listened to it to check. That is what it sounds like.
So imagine something coming from the inside of a bin, but in a good way, and you're halfway there. But actually, don't imagine that. Go to completemusicupdate.com/approved. Read more about this week's approved tracks and listen to all of the recommended musics.
Or you'll find them all linked to in the show notes for this show, which you can also find on the CMU website.
completemusicupdate.com/podcast.
Okay, then, back to legal stuff. PRS for Music has just launched a new campaign called Streamfair, which is, amongst other things, campaigning for an overhaul of the safe harbour system.
It is indeed. They're looking for fair legalities around streaming. It's not that they're hosting a fair all about streams. That's not what Streamfair is. It's fair as in being fair. Just want to clarify that.
Okay, good.
So if we consider it clarified. So yes, PRS, which is of course the collecting society for the UK songwriting and publishing community, launched a new campaign last week, and they're the latest sort of music organisation. The record industry trade groups have been on this, the songwriters have been on this already, to basically make a statement about what we call safe harbours in copyright law, and basically wanting that part of copyright law overhauled. Now, I don't think we've talked about safe harbours on the podcast because all of this originally kicked off before the podcast returned. Am I right in saying that?
Yes. I mean, I think we have discussed it on the podcast, but not in this new run with the all-new CMU podcast.
So I'm going to explain it to you. And if this doesn't make sense, then you have to sign up to the CMU premium service, because if you do and you go into the trends report section of the CMU website, only available to premium subscribers, sorry, freemium people, then I explain all of this in written form, and that might be easier to comprehend. But premium plug done, I'm going to have a go at doing it here on the podcast.
Okay, what are safe harbours, Chris Cook?
So, safe harbours are lines in copyright law, and usually when people talk about safe harbours, they're actually talking about American copyright law. So in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, there is a section that provides safe harbours for technology companies who inadvertently help other people to infringe copyright. And the safe harbours exist to protect those people from being sued. So, for example, they're really set up to help internet service providers or server hosting companies. So let's say I have a little bit of web hosting from a server company, and I set up a website, and then I use that website to infringe copyright. What the safe harbours say is that the record companies can't sue the server hosting company for the infringement, even though they are involved in the infringement, because they're providing the server space and the internet connection, the tools with which the infringement is happening. So the labels would have to come and sue me. And of course, I haven't got any money, so there's no point suing me, whereas the assumption is that the server hosting company has lots of money, and generally you sue the people involved who have the money. So the safe harbours were put there in the 1990s, and basically it was internet service providers and web hosting companies saying to Congress in the US and also here in Europe to the European Union, saying if we don't have this protection, if we could be held liable every time one of our customers infringes copyright, well, that puts a huge strain on ISPs and a huge strain on server hosting companies, which would have it would stop us growing in the way that we want to grow, and it would impeach the growth of the web and people using the web and all of the other internet things, and that makes sense. And so the US Congress, and I say over here it happened on the European level too, it sits in European law, provided these safe harbours that say that if you are, and the word they use in European law is mere conduit, so if you are a mere conduit in the distribution of copyright infringing content, and you are doing so inadvertently, so you don't know that this is going on, it's just that someone is using your system to infringe copyright, you can't be held liable for the infringement, so you can't be sued for lots of money. And that's all great. There is the proviso that if a copyright owner makes you aware of the infringement, you are obliged to act. And that's where you get the whole takedown system. And one of the reasons why often when people talk about takedowns, they say DMCA takedowns. And that's because this all in America stems from the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And so if I'm a server hosting company, I have to have a system, which is normally a form or an email address, whereby copyright owners can get in touch and say, hang on a second, that customer over there, they're on your server, they're using their website to infringe copyright, and you need to take that content down. And if you don't, then you might become liable for copyright infringement. So you have the protection, providing you do the takedowns. So that's the basic of safe harbours. And I think at a basic level, copyright owners reluctantly accept that they are necessary. It would be impractical to make all ISPs and server hosting companies liable for all of the infringement that their customers do. But the record companies and the music publishers and the songwriters and the artists are increasingly saying that they think these safe harbours are being abused by a certain group of companies. Really, they mean YouTube. Yeah. They don't normally call YouTube out directly, but this is really aimed at YouTube. Although, obviously, there are other similar sites to YouTube. Dailymotion is the big one, mainly in France, but they have users in mainland Europe. And to an extent, SoundCloud would fall under this bracket too, although SoundCloud is busy doing its licensing deals. But what the labels are saying is YouTube also uses the safe harbours. So this is how YouTube is able to run an opt-out streaming service rather than an opt-in streaming service. So Spotify only has content when a label has specifically said, we want to be part of Spotify, let's do a deal, here's our content. Whereas obviously with YouTube, anyone can upload content to YouTube. And so it's the other way around. If a label doesn't want to be on YouTube, they have to go to YouTube and have the content removed. And obviously, YouTube has a system called Content ID that facilitates this process. So if you're a record company and people are uploading your content, Content ID, in theory, spots it on upload. It may or may not work. It does work quite a lot of the time, although it's not 100% perfect. And Content ID will say to you as the label, you're the copyright owner on this. This content has been uploaded. Do you want to either block the content or monetize the content? And you can either choose to have the content removed, or you can choose to take a share in the advertising revenue that's generated and generate some revenue. But the labels are increasingly saying that safe harbors were not designed for services like YouTube. And that actually they think a line should be drawn. Okay, ISPs, yes. Web hosting companies, yes. But once you've got a website that allows people to upload content and then aggregates that content and represents it through a different homepage, i.e. YouTube.com, that at that point the safe harbours shouldn't apply. And that actually YouTube should not be able to say, it's not our problem if people upload copyright infringing content because we do takedowns through Content ID over here, so we're all fine. The labels would like the law to be rewritten to say safe harbours, safe harbours, safe harbours, but not, well, it wouldn't be as specific as I say, but not for YouTube, but not for services that then re-aggregate the content and present it through a centralised homepage.
And this has become a particular problem in recent years as streaming services like Spotify, which you mentioned, have grown and become more and more important to the music industry. Because, I mean, YouTube, music key aside, YouTube is the biggest streaming site in the world, the biggest music streaming service in the world. And if that company can have whatever content they want as an, you know, opt out, as you say, rather than opt in, services like Spotify that are trying to grow on the other side but have to be opt-in, are at a disadvantage and are therefore going to struggle to catch and grow past YouTube because YouTube can have whatever content it wants.
Because it has this advantage. And you do sense, because I mean, obviously, YouTube is a licensed service. So YouTube isn't a service that has no deals with record companies or music publishers. It has lots of deals with record companies and music publishers. So you could say, well, what are the labels talking about? And that is what YouTube is saying. What are you talking about? You all licensed us. We're paying you money. You know, everyone's happy with this service. But the labels, having been big YouTube users and doing those deals years ago and having had the revenue coming in, have started to get much more critical of that specific service. And as you say, we sense that's because you've got services like Spotify and Deezer and Ardio who are generally paying higher royalties. They're taking a bigger risk. They're making bigger commitments to the labels. They're desperate to sign people up. And they're increasingly turning round to Sony and Universal and Warner and to the indies. And they're saying, it's really hard for us to grow our free user base, let alone our premium user base, when there are, you know, so many people, when they want streaming music, they just go and stream it on YouTube. And you need to constrain YouTube. And what the labels are saying is, okay, yes, YouTube is licensed. Okay, yes, Content ID, it's a great system. But because YouTube can say at the negotiating table, we already have all of your content. And if you don't want to monetize it, if you won't do a licensing deal, you now have to hire a whole team of people to manage your Content ID account and to do more monitoring of our site for anything that slips through Content ID, and you have to do that at your expense with no hope of royalties if you won't do a licensing deal with us, then that increases YouTube's negotiating hand at the negotiating table. And as a result of that, that's why YouTube keeps getting so much more preferential rates than a Spotify or a Deezer or an RDO. And so what the labels want, and now the songwriters and the publishers too, through this PRS campaign, is they're saying, now the focus is on Europe, because as it happens, copyright law is up for a review in Europe. And people in Brussels are already reviewing the way copyright law works. And so the lobbying effort, this is, you know, a specifically timed campaign to say to Brussels, you need to change the law in Europe. We can't change it in America in the near future, although that is on our agenda long term. But if we could just get it changed in Europe so that YouTube would have to take on more of the responsibility. So if I said to YouTube, I'm not doing a licensing deal, it would be then their problem to ensure that my content is not on YouTube, not my problem, then I could demand more money and better terms from YouTube and they'd have to pay us.
So yeah, all of this is going to be fought out in Brussels over the next year or however long. But from what we hear, Google isn't particularly concerned, doesn't expect to lose on this.
No, it's the word is that the lobbyists and lawyers at YouTube keep saying to people who talk about this, that they keep saying to the labels and the publishers, but Content ID does all of this. And we suspect that that's what they're going to say to legislators and decision makers in Brussels. It is interesting. This is PRS joining the IFPI, which represents the record companies, Impala, which represents the indie labels in Europe, Basker, which represents the songwriting community, which PRS does to an extent as well. But all the different parts of the music industry are coming together on this one. So that's interesting that the music industry is going to speak as one. Although Google is a phenomenal lobby, I mean, particularly in Washington, but even in Brussels, Google have a lot of lobbyists with a lot of power and influence in Brussels. Plus, of course, there is the slighter side to this, that although in theory the music industry is speaking as one, and we've got labels and publishers and PRS all shouting about this, there is that point that Google will say, but if we had to verify every single upload to our platform, if that became our responsibility, that just wouldn't work. Okay, we couldn't afford to do that. Now, you could say that's a bluff, and actually, if they invested another few million in Content ID, they could make it super duper more efficient, and actually, they could. But they will say, you know, if the safe harbors were to go, we'd have to shut YouTube down. And for the labels, the idea of losing YouTube as a marketing tool, they don't want to go there. OK, yeah. YouTube is such an important place for marketing new music and new releases. So although the music industry is sort of speaking as one on this, the marketing departments at the labels are not. So
there's a seed of doubt.
There is. And
which
so
is,
we will see maybe later this year, if not earlier next year, whether or not Google's sort of typical arrogance on this one is justified or whether this is something that the music industry can win.
Before we get on to our last story, we just have time to run through what we didn't have time to talk about this week, starting with quite a big one, Facebook's music service.
So I think we mentioned last week that Facebook was talking to the major record companies, but we didn't really know about what. Well, Music Ally has found a sneaky source, and the source is telling us two things. A, as we expected, stage one is that they want to start running music videos. Obviously, Facebook video has grown hugely in the last year or so, and they want to start running music videos pretty much exactly like YouTube do. So they could get caught up with the whole safe harbors thing too, I don't know. But interestingly, beyond their ambitions in music video, there is then a second stage to the plan to launch a fully fledged audio service on par with a Spotify and an Apple Music. That then led to the speculation, will they buy Spotify? Will they buy an existing service and just plug it in? Although Music Ally Source says at the moment they are thinking of building an audio service from scratch. So Facebook looks like they're going to be entering music in the next year.
Yeah, sounds like a great idea.
who wouldn't want yet another streaming service?
CSAC has bought the Harry Fox Agency.
Collective licensing news here.
Yes.
CSAC is a performing rights organisation for songwriters and publishers in America. It is the smallest. There are more than one performing rights organisation in the US. It's the smallest. Actually, that's not true anymore because Irving Azoff's Global Music Rights is probably smaller. It's one of the smaller ones. It has bought the Harry Fox Agency, which is the mechanical rights, or it's one of the mechanical rights organisations in the US. I'm not even going to start getting into any more about that.
That that happened because that was complicated.
People tried to gatecrash wireless. That's easier to talk about.
That is easy to talk about. I mean, you basically just said it. But yeah, it was the Wireless Festival last weekend. People did try to gatecrash it. People did gatecrash it.
They did.
It was a festival that's it's moved around a bit, but now it's
originally Hyde Park, now Finsbury Park.
And I suppose the difference between where it's been before and where it is now, Finsbury Park is in quite a built-up residential area, and so it's close enough that people can wander around I think people would wander around and like hang out outside to hear music coming over the fence. But the fences, they have these gates that aren't particularly strong.
Well, I'm assuming those fences are emergency exits, so they have to be.
They obviously have to have these exits, but there were various YouTube videos showing people trying to break through, and then there's one video where someone on the inside
opens the gate.
Yeah, the security stopped trying to hold it back, and someone walks over and just flips up.
But you say, entrance. Although this got a lot of coverage this year, when Rage Against the Machine played Finsbury Park, which is what, 2 years ago now, or maybe
I think
even
longer.
More than
that. I think in 2012.
They had a very similar fence and gate system, and they had the same problem then.
Yeah.
Although I think what happened this year was that video of people actually getting in went viral on Friday evening because it was the first day of the festival, which then persuaded more people to show up.
If you watch the videos from Saturday, there were a lot of people outside
trying to get
in. Because
everyone was like, oh, we'll get in. And I don't think any did, or certainly not many did on the Saturday. But anyway, that's interesting.
Big Machine is not for sale.
What's Big Machine, Andy?
Big Machine is an...
It's not a Big Machine, it's the Big Machine.
Yes, it's an independent country music label in America, most notable for the fact that one of its artists is Taylor Swift, who is quite popular.
And she's been with the label pretty much throughout her career,
yes,
hasn't she?
And there was some speculation that she's coming to the end of her contract with the company. And I think, actually, I don't think it was speculated. I think it was Scott Borchetta, the guy who owns the label, was shopping it around to sell it.
Yes.
But apparently now he's not.
He's not. No, the story went that somebody approached him and offered him money for the label last year. He wasn't looking to sell, but then he was like, oh, that's interesting. So then he then got his people to approach other people, including the majors and a few tech companies, whether or not they were interested in buying it. Story was that had Universal or Sony taken it, that part of the deal was that Scott Borchetta would get a senior role. Actually, one rumour was that he wanted the top job, that he would be the next person to get the top job at Sony Music. But anyway, whatever. None of those deals has come good. And instead, he said he's going to keep it in the current ownership. I have a feeling the Swift family have a stake in it. But they're going to keep it with the current shareholders and the current owners, although they renewed and upgraded their distribution deal with Universal. So
yeah,
you can't buy Big Machine, I'm afraid.
Nope. Xbox Music is no longer Xbox Music. It's now called Microsoft Groove.
Because who wouldn't want to stream their music from a service called Groove?
Well, apparently the problem was that Xbox Music was available to anyone, but people thought it was only available through Xboxes. And this, apparently, this communicates that it's available to anyone. I'm not sure it communicates anything at all.
So go Groove, people. Talking of streaming services, Michael Robertson.
One of our favourite rogue music industry people.
Who was the founder of MP3.com and then had that MP3 Tunes was the digital locker service he ran. He basically seems to always set up new services just to piss off rights owners. His latest service, what it does is it monitors thousands of online radio stations. So, you know, sort of Radio 1 and other stations that are simulcasting, but also online-only radio stations, which are broadcasting live. And then if you go in and say, I want to listen to a Taylor Swift track, pick your Taylor Swift track, it will then have a look out of all of the thousand stations it's monitoring. Is there one currently playing it? And if it's a Taylor Swift track, they probably are.
Yeah.
And it will then, it's called 6 seconds, the app. And I think the idea is that within 6 seconds,
it will find you the song you want.
Find you the station, tune you into it. And then at the end of that song, you can either stay tuned to that radio station or you can go off and listen to something else. And there are playlists within the system that will jump you around all these radio stations. And obviously his idea is he doesn't need to get licenses for that service because the radio stations which you are linking to are already licensed.
Yes.
Although if this takes off and gets any decent user base, I suspect the labels would want to disagree. But there was an upgrade to the app this week.
Yes, so he has bolted onto that a thing called Free Beats One, which you might know has a similar name to something else. And that's because it's a service that rather than you having to sign into Apple Music's Beats One, radio station, it will just find the tracks that Beats One is playing for you elsewhere.
Yeah, so it's taking the Beats One playlist and finding you for elsewhere. Although Michael Robertson in his blog was saying, so you won't have to listen to the DJs, you won't have to listen to Zane Lowe waffling on. Although presumably you would hear little bits of the DJs at the start and the end of the records as it jumps around the different stations. So I'm not sure it would be that more of a user-friendly
like
experience.
Like we say, he does tend to do things that do just appear to be just to piss off the music industry.
But it's a fun app that you might want to go and try, but don't tell any labels I told you that.
Phil Rudd.
Off of AC/DC.
Well, I was going to say formally, but I don't know. Well, formally at the moment, because he's been sentenced to 8 months under house arrest.
So he was charged just as AC/DC were announcing a new tour last year. He was charged with, well, initially he was charged with hiring a hitman to kill a guy.
Yeah.
Then they downgraded it to threatening to kill the guy. It was all something to do with an argument over the release of his solo album, and he was unhappy with the way it had been promoted. But he was charged with threatening to kill a guy. He ultimately pleaded guilty. He was sentenced this week, and it was house arrest. How long?
8 months.
8 months under house arrest, and he
so
has
he's
to
definitely
go.
Not in AC. AC/DC haven't said that he's out forever, but he's definitely out for 8 months.
And the best bit of the court ruling was Rudd's lawyer was saying, please don't constrain him to his house because he wants to go back on tour with the band and he'll lose a lot of money if he doesn't. And the judge said, well, A, it doesn't really seem like the band want him on tour. And you can't tell me that AC/DC can't operate without Phil Rudd on drums, because Queen replaced Freddie Mercury, so AC/DC can replace Phil Rudd. So there you go. It's all Adam Lambert's fault.
Adam Lambert doesn't play drums.
He does not.
Chris Moyles has been linked to the XFM breakfast show.
Lots of rumours around XFM. Apparently set for a relaunch over the summer or possibly in September.
Possibly with a new name.
Possibly with a new name. Someone was speculating Capital Rocks. Which is an awful name for a radio station. But they did rebrand Global, that owns all of these radio stations. They did rebrand Choice as Capital Extra, didn't they?
Yes.
So who knows? Perhaps it will become, or maybe Capital X. I don't know. But anyway, amongst rumours about changes at XFM are that Chris Moyles will finally be returning to radio to present The Breakfast Show. So we'll see.
Yeah, big news of this week. Live Nation's official fuel and lubricant partners
were announced, and in the case of the latter, were renewed. This is in the US. This is for their amphitheatre venues in the US. A big brand partnership. Can you remember the name of the official lubricant partner?
Well, it was Pennzoil.
Something like that,
I
wasn't
think
it?
So, yeah. And that's where would you be without official fuel and lubricant partners?
And anybody working in the live music industry listening to the podcast, if you haven't got yourself an official lubricant partner for 2015, stop listening now and go and sort that out.
Anyone in the fuel and lubricant business who wants to sponsor us?
Yes.
Get in touch.
You could be the official lubricant of the CME podcast. We're up for that. give us a shout. You could be with us by the next edition.
Yeah. Coming to the end of this list, this is quite a long list.
It is quite a long list.
Damon Albarn was physically removed from the Roskilde stage.
It was quite amusing. Go and look it up online.
Yes. He refused to leave the stage after a 5-hour set with Africa Express. Someone had to carry him off. Ariana Grande loves America but hates donuts.
Explain this story to us, Andy. You wrote this one.
Yes.
You were quite angry about this.
Ariana Grande this week, TMZ got hold of some security footage from a donut shop in which Ariana Grande and some friends are waiting to buy donuts. In this footage, she licks a donut while donut shop staff are not looking. And then when the person serving turns up and puts a tray of donuts on the counter, she shouts, "What the fuck is that? I hate America and I hate Americans."
Now, this was a scandal in America, but the thing that was scandal in America was different to the thing that outraged you.
Yeah.
You and America were...
Well, I don't know.
Were,
I mean, I think
two minds.
Both things have been scandalous, but apparently the thing that she apologized decided that
for.
She had to apologise for on Twitter in a quite lengthy statement was the fact that she'd said she hates America. And did in this long statement did not mention the fact that she'd licked a donut
and then
that
put
someone
it
else was going to buy. Disgusting.
Also, if she was saying it was a general statement against obesity and that people in America just eat all this junk food and people should be... But she had gone into a donut shop. If you're a health food advocate, I would suggest it's worth not going into donut shops.
And she basically said, oh, I would have said it differently if I'd known that I was being filmed.
But
it's like, you still shouted, "What the fuck is that?" into someone's face. He was just trying to do their job.
Yeah, putting some donuts down on in a donut shop.
And licked a donut.
So, there you go. Hey, what's our last story, Andy?
65 days of static. In fact, well, it's not just them. 15 artists and 3 songwriters have been awarded money, grants of between £8,000 and £15,000 by the Music Export Growth Scheme.
Or MEGS.
MEGS, as apparently it is called, which is a government scheme to help artists take their music abroad.
Yes, so this is a joint venture between UK Trade and Investment, which is a government agency, and the BPI, which is the Record Industry's trade body. It's been running for a couple of years, and basically artists signed to smaller, middle-sized labels, so not to big majors, to independent record companies, can apply for some money if they think that they're doing okay in the UK, but they want to launch themselves in other territories, either for a tour or for an album campaign, and they need some money to help them. They can apply to this fund, and 2 or 3 times a year, we get a list of all the artists who are getting some money, and what they're going to do with the money. And this list that came out on the weekend, at the top of the list, because it was in alphabetical order and the numbers go first, at the top of the list, getting some government funding was 65 Days of Static. One would assume that they would be really excited about that.
Yes, but they published a blog post in which, well, they kind of went through the press release that had been sent out through the government PR, picking holes in it and generally dissing the people who are giving them money.
And it got the government's business secretary quoted saying, we love music and this is us supporting the UK music industry, blah, blah, blah. And 65 Days of Static were basically saying, we're happy to take this cash, but we're not happy to be held up as you know, part of the Conservative government doing anything good for the arts or music.
Do you want to know what they exactly said?
What did
they exactly say? Said they didn't want to be held up in any way as evidence that this hyper-Dickensian fucking nightmare of a Tory government is apparently supporting the arts.
Yes.
When they said they were in fact destroying any kind of infrastructure for future creativity at grassroots level.
They also took offence, aside from the Tories sort of gaining brownie points for this, but also there was quite a lot of talk in the press release about how that this was about economic growth and it was about sort of, you know, helping the economy. And these guys were sort of saying, you know, no, it's about creating great music. It's about, you know, exploring our art. It's not about us. Just adding a few more percentage points to the Conservatives.
Yeah, talking about how good it will be for the economy entirely misses the point of why we need to support arts and creativity in the first place. And they also picked up on a number of things that the press release says, like the music companies that these bands work with will match any money that they've been granted.
And they've said news to us.
They said this is the first we've heard about it. And we're not sure which of the many music companies we work with are supposed to be handing over extra money for us. The press release also said that the bands involved would be attending writing camps overseas to help boost the revenues that come from publishing and sync deals. And they said if the government thinks they're going to do that, they've got another thing coming.
They also talked about how even if they got the money, it was to fund an American tour, although the plans for the American tour seem to be a little bit vague. But they want to go on tour in America. That's expensive for a band on that scale. And so that's what they're going to use the money on. But they were very keen to say that you know, even if this tour goes ahead and they spend whatever money it is they're getting from the government, actually, they won't get the money in their pockets. And in the end, actually, most of the money will probably go to an airline and to a van hire company and to the petrol company that they put in the van.
Yeah.
So actually, you know, big airlines and big oil companies will ultimately be the beneficiaries of this money.
Yeah, because they described it as a hypothetical tour. It was something they'd seen that this grant was available, and so they put together a bid for it. But it was a tour that wasn't planned because they didn't know
whether
if they were
going to
get the money or not. And they were saying, even now, when the money they've received will cover about a third of the cost of the tour. And it's basically they've done this soundtrack for a video game, which is being released in America. And it would be nice to be able to tour America and support that music while there's sort of something to support. But it's still up in the air whether they can afford to go. This money that's apparently helping the art is actually helping
big business.
Big business.
So there you go. If you want to read the full rant, and it was quite long and quite interesting and quite amusing in parts, go and have a look. It's on 65 Days of Static's website. If you Google them, they will come up. Also, while you're there, check out their music because they're quite an interesting and good band that's definitely well worth checking out. We're sort of coming to the end of this podcast, and I feel we don't have a cliffhanger ending. What could our cliffhanger
be? We can't have a cliffhanger everywhere. You know where that sort of thing leads.
What?
We end up with me drinking.
6 hours a week dedicated on desperately trying to come up with the cliffhanger ending for this podcast. But, we'll be back next week.
Or will we?
Unless the Conservative, what was the word they used? The Dickensian.
Hyper-Dickensian.
Fucking nightmare of a Tory government. You know, they might kill the internet. So perhaps we won't be here next week. We'll have to see.
Yes, but in the meantime, while the internet still exists, if you want to read up on any of the stories we've talked about this week, you can go to completemusicupdate.com and check the show notes. There's a little link top right of the website. You'll see it. And all the links to all the stories are in there to make it easy for you. You don't have to use our search system, which is not
brilliant.
Always very good.
It's the word you're looking for.
Brilliant. Brilliant. It is brilliant, but I wouldn't want you to be blinded by its brilliance. But before you do that, subscribe to the podcast wherever you like to receive podcasts. Go on everywhere you can, write reviews, rate it 5 stars, please. Share it far and wide on social networks, and then follow us on those social networks. We are at CMU on Twitter. We are Complete Music Update on Facebook.
And we promise that if you support us in any way, we won't come back next week with a blog post slacking you off. Because we're not 65 days of static.
Yes, but that is the end of this podcast.
Do those final little lines that we do at the
end
of
the podcast. I'm
trying to. Go on. I'm looking forward to it.
It's presented by me, Andy Morton, that guy, Chris Cook, produced by Matt Peaty. And as I said already, but it bears repeating, for more information on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.